Hello, it's Tom here. We've got a brilliant episode of Last Orders for you today, but before we get into that, I just want to quickly remind you all about Spiked Supporters. This is our thriving donor community for those of you who give to Spiked regularly. So now those who give £5 or more each month or £50 or more each year can get exclusive perks. You can comment on articles, you can get discounts on all items in our shop, and you can get free and discounted tickets to Spiked events. So if you'd like to come along to any of our upcoming events, which we'll be announcing soon, and you're not already a Spiked supporter, then why not sign up today? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to find out more and to sign up. Once again, that's spiked-online.com/supporters. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast all about freedom, the nanny state, and censorship. In this episode, we discuss Extinction Rebellion, the war on vaping, and Australia's zero COVID nightmare. Hello, and welcome to Last Orders for a very special episode. It's the first time that we're actually all in the same room for what, 18 months,
yeah.
Chris? So, of course, I'm joined as ever by Chris Snowden, Director of Lifestyle Economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs. We've finally coaxed you up to London. Listeners can't see, but he's got a face shield on, three masks.
Hazmat suit.
In this small and ventilated room.
Small ventilated room. How are you, Chris?
I'm, to be honest, quite hungover, but I will, as always, give my all for the listeners. They deserve nothing less.
We don't doubt it. And we're delighted to be joined again by Mark Littlewood, Director General of the IEA. And since we last seen you, Mark, you've become a YouTuber as well. So the host of the Live with Littlewood show that I'm sure a lot of listeners will have seen.
Yeah,
well.
we have. It's interesting for the IEA. I mean, obviously, the disruption of the last 18 months meant we had to kind of rethink how to do things. We've had a YouTube channel for well over a decade. But necessity is the mother of invention, right? So we have suddenly developed, done a lot of content for it. I do a show most Wednesdays, Live with Littlewood, just a chat show, free market look at the events of the week. But Chris has his own show every fortnight, Swift Off with Snowden. Mark Glendening has his show, The Parallax View. And it's been quite a revelation, really. If you were, this is oversimplistic, but if you were just to measure kind of bangs for buck, you know, how many eyeballs are you getting for each pound spent? It's by far and away the best value for money output that the IEA does. So, yeah, we've grown it during lockdown, but we will stick with it as normality returns.
Excellent. If you haven't watched any of those videos, do go to the IEA's YouTube channel to see all those different shows, including Chris's as well. So first off, we're going to talk about Extinction Rebellion, which is always good fun. So they're back. They're in the middle of their 2 weeks of disruption, their impossible rebellion, all the kind of usual craft table, shtick, street theatre, giant pink table in the street. As ever, it seems like a kind of exercise in alienating as many people as possible. I mean, they were pouring fake blood into the fountains outside of Buckingham Palace. They're going after the Queen, that very hated figure in the country, which is quite interesting. But Chris, what do you make of all of this? Do you think the shine's coming off them a little bit? Because they used to get a bit more of a positive hearing, I feel like, at least with the press, and they do.
With the press, not with the commuters.
No, definitely not.
Bermondsey, or wherever it was. Still one of the funniest video clips I've ever seen. These people being chased down the top of a tube train and beaten up. They do honestly seem like they want people to dislike them and go off the cause. And I'm kind of fascinated by the psychology of the people in it, both the leaders, people like Roger Hallam, who seem frankly nuts. You know, there's no other way of putting it, really. And their followers. There's quite an interesting documentary. I think it's called Inside Extinction Rebellion or something like that by Sky, came out a year or two ago. And it's a very neutral, matter-of-fact documentary. But reading between the lines, you can tell a lot about the people involved. Firstly, these protests and the movement itself, it's the poshest protest movement I've ever seen. It makes like the pro-EU rallies look like the peasants' revolt. You know, you can say what you like about the anti-vaccine protests, anti-lockdown protests, and I've said a lot about them, but they do seem to be a genuine cross-section of society. Yeah. Whereas Extinction Rebellion, it's like the discontented upper middle classes, people who've been to university and studied drama, have not managed to get a job out of it at the end of the day. And it's very clear when you look at these protests from how much music there is, how much performance art and contemporary dance and all this kind of stuff. It's got obviously nothing to do with the cause. Mm. It's just people showing off. So I think the media really should try and ignore. I think the police should crack down on them for a start off, you know, maybe rubber bullets, for example. But if not that, a fire hose, there's loads of options, dogs. They should crack down, make an example of them, because I don't think any of these people are going to last very long in prison. So just a few.
Well, that's what they want to do. Their aim is to get arrested, isn't it?
To get arrested. I know. I think they have a different idea to what it's like inside. they might get a shock. I think some short, sharp prison sentences for the ringleaders and the worst offenders are clearly breaking loads of laws. I'm no lawyer, but they're disrupting the highway, given whatever the maximum sentence is for that and anything else they're doing. And the media should kind of ignore them.
Yeah.
And I think maybe they might go away.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, because my inclination is that they aren't really a political movement at all. Mm. This is a sort of hobby. Let's go out for a day in London and, you know, do a bit of miming and contemporary dance and play musical chairs. And it's a sort of jolly japes of a day out. And it's extremely difficult to actually get out of them what they want. Obviously, the rallying cries, we're worried about the climate emergency. We're all, you get the, but in terms of propositions, what do they want? A carbon tax? I mean,
they've got three demands, haven't they? Yeah. Demands are, they want to go net zero by 2025.
Yeah, right.
4 years net zero. Well, the 2050 target is totally unachievable. Mm. This is obviously ludicrous. They want the politicians to officially declare a climate emergency, which, as far as I know, they've already done.
Parliament did it. 2019, Parliament did that.
And they want a people's parliament.
Which is what the House of Commons is.
Yeah.
They don't know.
Well, they want one of these kind of fake Potemkin parliaments where experts feed them the information and then they make a decision via that sort of means. But the class point you raised, Chris, is so stark. I mean, it's only diverse insofar as it feels like so many sections of the white middle class are represented, because you've got like the art school types who look like they got lost on the way back from a festival or whatever. But then there's always like a few religious people, vicars. The fact that it was founded in Stroud, I think, tells you everything you possibly need to know about all of this stuff. But on that point about net zero, because as you say, they want it by 2025, but Mark, the government is committed to net zero anyway. I mean, are they really just kind of railing against a government that basically already agrees with them on lots of stuff?
Thank you for clarifying what their demands are, although I'm still not sure I'm really any the wiser, because it seems to me that there is no demand that will satisfy them. Let's just imagine, and Chris, I agree with you, I think getting to carbon net zero by 2050 is the wrong policy and we won't get there. But supposing the government did say, actually, we'll go for carbon net zero by 2025. That's what we're going to do. Extinction Rebellion would, I think, not declare victory. They would say, oh, no, it's got to be by 2023. It's got to be by next Thursday, right? I mean, so it's, you cannot satiate their demands, I think it is. And dealing with them or negotiating with them is like feeding your right arm to the alligator in the hope that you'll satiate its appetite. It's just not going to happen.
But their slogan for these protests is demand the impossible, isn't it?
Called Impossible Rebellion.
They basically know that this stuff is not going to happen, cannot happen. And I guess that gives them a chance to continue dancing around and poncing about forever.
But I think this isn't unique to Extinction Rebellion, which is that for a lot of this kind of bourgeois pseudo-left protest, it is just like self-expression at this point. Yeah, it's just, look at me, I'm part of this movement, all of this stuff. The demands are kind of neither here nor there.
It gives them meaning, I think. It's another symptom of sending too many people to university. It's also, in a way, a symptom of meritocracy. It's like these people probably think they're born to rule. You know, I suspect a lot of them, you know, they come from families where they are part of the unofficial ruling class, and they find themselves elbowed out of what they want to do in drama and television or music by people who are better at it. And this is their revolt. The revolt of the elites.
Would you say it's similar to the Occupy movement? I was quite fascinated by the Occupy movement. I took my life into my hands and went along to meet them at St. Paul's Cathedral, just talking to a few random people. I said, I roughly agree with you. I don't support the bailout of banks. Can I bring some Hayek literature for your library about the denationalisation? Well, they were bemused, really. I mean, but I sort of thought, maybe we're on the same side here. You don't want bank bailouts. I don't want bank bailouts. I want, companies that fall should not be subsidised by the state. You seem to be sort of speaking to the IEA script here a bit. but again, it wasn't tangible. I mean, there wasn't sort of, no, actually, we think there should be one nationalised bank and, run not-for-profit. They didn't have any of those sort of plans at all.
No.
It was just another kind of collective screen
with drum circles.
Yeah, and similar sort of this sort of festival type thing. Mm-hmm. You know, not an old fashioned demo where you're chanting and you know got your flags and your, you know, it was all a rather, you know, a jolly jape and a few nice days out and let's sit around in the, you know, library and play musical chairs. It's quite bizarre.
Glastonbury's been cancelled the last 2 years. I think that partly explains climate extinction. extinction rebellion, whatever they're called.
Yeah.
I think we should, before we move on, we should probably talk a little bit about the hypocrisy stuff because that's been a huge feature of the discussion. So Gail Bradbrook is one of their co-founders, an academic, was caught out because she still drives a diesel car. Alok Sharma and Allegra Stratton from the government have been caught out on this as well. She was also found to have whilst talking about the fact that no one should fly anywhere, jetted off to a psychedelics retreat in Costa Rica a couple of years ago. Yeah. Apparently that's where the idea for Extinction Rebellion was born, while she was off her nuts there. So that's been a kind of big part of this discussion. I mean, the line from Extinction Rebellion has actually been, well, we're all hypocrites, aren't we? But Mark, is this just kind of the fact that the kind of world they're calling for is miserable? Like, no one wants to see less of the world. No one wants to replace a cheap and reliable car with something that's expensive and unreliable. Is it this just showing up that no one really wants deep down this lifestyle that they want to bring?
That has to be right. Okay. And a very common refrain of mine, and I'm becoming a bit one note about it, is the difference between people's stated preferences and revealed preferences. And it's why I'm becoming even more skeptical about opinion polls. You know, if you go and ask people, would you like to see a massive reduction in carbon emissions, and Maury or somebody asks them that, you know, 90% for sake of argument will say yes. When you look at people's revealed preferences, right, you know, so if you stopped going on holiday then, have you abandoned your car and replaced it with a horse and cart? you know, are you just wearing jumpers and switching off the heating? And the revealed preferences show that people are not minded by this, and indeed the revealed preferences of the leading campaigners themselves, right? So I mean, even this hardcore minority who want to disrupt London, don't you? So, and all of that, you know, it's part of this sort of new irrational politics, though, isn't it? There are no demands that you can easily fulfil here. Indeed, as Chris has pointed out, they are proudly saying that their demands are impossible to meet. a badge of pride for them. And they don't seem to be, you know, willing on the phone, massive generalisation, of course, but on the face of it, they don't seem to be living the agrarian peasant lifestyle that they would like to impose on the rest of us. So I would have thought that should be at least their first step, you know. Mm. It's maddening, really. They're extremely irritating.
Fancy that. I mean, people expect their lives to get better, don't they? That's what most people think politics is about. You know, a bit more money in your pocket, be able to go on holiday more, but no, not this luck. Are you looking for the perfect gift for the pro-freedom, anti-woke person in your life? Then look no further than the Spiked Shop. You can now get your favourite Spiked slogan on a t-shirt, hoodie, tote bag or mug, including ban nothing, question everything, love Europe, hate the EU and cancel culture. Plus, if you're a Spiked supporter, you can get a 15% discount off of everything. Just go to spiked-online.com/shop to browse our items and make your purchases. That's spiked-online.com/shop. We should talk a bit about some smoking and vaping stories, Chris, because there's been a good selection last few weeks. So first of all, there's this discussion about whether or not the legal age for both smoking and vaping should be raised to 21. Mm. As far as I can tell in the reporting, Sajid Javid is more inclined to raising the vaping age rather than the smoking age, but nevertheless, this is still on the table. And the context for this is Matt Hancock's smoke-free England by 2030 policy, I think, which I didn't even remember. I mean, that's a crazy idea.
It's Theresa May again. So she committed herself to smoke-free by 2030 and carbon-free by 2050 and then bugged it off and left everybody else to work out how you're going to do this. It's obviously not going to happen. Also, we've got to halve childhood obesity by 2030 as well. Politicians just come up with these stupid targets, make them legally binding. I love the legally binding aspect of it.
Like the police will come around if they don't meet
it. If we don't go smoke-free by 2030, who goes to prison?
Theresa May.
Is it Theresa May or is it the current government? Well, I hope it is Theresa May. That would be fine. I might start smoking again. That's the case. Yeah, I don't know what's going on with this. It's inspired by what's been happening in America. So America had a big scare about vaping. Teen vaping, Evali, which is e-cigarette. Oh, I can't remember what it stands for, but it was a lung injury sort of epidemic, which turned out to be caused by
black market THC, which was adulterated by something called vitamin E. It had nothing to do with nicotine vaping, but the anti-vaping people ran with it, and they got loads of flavors banned, and the FDA just this week has refused permission for 55,000 vaping liquids to be put on the market because the manufacturers have failed to show public health benefit from doing so. But part of this moral panic has been they've raised the smoking and vaping age to 21. Really, what they were trying to do was raise the vaping age to 21, but it seemed kind of inconsistent to not also raise the smoking age, which, from what you're saying, is an inconsistency that our chancellor hasn't, or our health secretary, I should say, hasn't noticed. Now, in America, of course, you can't drink until you're 21. So it's a bit more difficult to argue against it. In this country, there isn't anything you can't do until you're 21 that I can think of. So it's more of a hard sell. And it's obviously a particularly hard sell when they are, jabbing 12-year-olds, well, parents' consent, if those rumors are correct, but also campaigning for the voting age to be dropped to 16, which a very large number of
you. You are at 16, you are now old enough to determine what the nature of the government should be, but not mature enough to work out whether or not you can smoke cigarettes, drink alcohol, yeah, or the rest of it. And that's just an absurdity.
And a lot of this, especially the focus on vaping, because we've talked about this a lot, but if you were to find one intervention, one technology which could actually deliver something resembling a smoke-free England, it would. Vaping is your best bet. Even Public Health England said a few years ago that it's at least 95% safer, and that's them hedging their bets.
They need to update that estimate, really, because I mean, it seems to me to be around about 100%.
But is it?
I still haven't had a single person die.
Am I right in this that actually a smoke-free England, Britain, or whatever, I think is defined as the smoking rate being 5%
that's
or
right,
lower?
Yeah.
I was on a panel run by the New Statesman and Philip Morris to discuss it. I found this absolutely extraordinary that was the definition of smoke-free. I mean, in that case, we live in a heroin-free Britain, fewer than 5% people. We live in a murder-free Britain. We live in an armed robbery-free Britain. I mean,
there's no problem
bizarre, to call that smoke-free. I mean, what's smoking prevalence? About 15%.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not like carbon net zero. At least that does what it says on the tin. Yeah. This is actually just sort of seeking to reduce smoking. There's no smoke-free at the moment. It would just be cutting it by two-thirds.
But it's still going to be impossible to meet, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see, particularly by 2030, it's absolutely ridiculous. But it's also just that point about, and we've said it a lot, but really a lot of this comes down to, they say it's about health, but it is just about puritanism at the end of the day. It's like that thought experiment you've talked about, a bit about before, Chris, which is if they could just somehow make cigarettes completely safe, people would probably still want to ban them. And with vaping, you get a bit of an insight.
Into exactly what's happened.
Well, and people still want to vape them.
Let's go back to old-fashioned cigarettes for a second. So plain packs, we've had them for quite a long time. Well, they're not plain, obviously. They're
horrible packs.
Plastered in horrible warnings. But there's been a randomised control trial looking into the effectiveness of this intervention. Seems to have found along similar lines to what every other study has found, which is that it might make people a bit more concerned about their health, but doesn't really change.
Doesn't have any effect whatsoever on behavior. This study, unfortunately, got absolutely no attention in the media. And it also portrayed itself as being a randomized controlled trial of graphic warnings, which is a slightly different issue. Actually, if you read the study, they used plain packs. In fact, they literally used the plain packs that have been used in Australia for the last 9 years. And it was a randomized controlled trial in the sense that they got a whole bunch of smokers and they gave half of them plain packs by mail order. This is during lockdown, I think. They were sending them cigarettes by post. They were buying them. The smokers were paying for them. But some of them got the plain packs, some of them got the conventional packs, and a third group got totally plain packs. There was no graphic warnings on them either. And essentially, there was no difference whatsoever. And the authors themselves said they designed the study so that even the slightest effect should be noticeable. They would have been happy just to see a reduction in cigarette consumption of one a day. That to them would have shown that these warnings and the plain packs had some effect. They didn't even get that. They got absolutely nothing from this. And it kills two birds with one stone, actually, because it shows that graphic warnings don't work and it shows that plain packs don't work, because that's what they ended up using. And yet, we've had this policy in place for the last 4 years or so. I was actually looking at the plain packaging literature recently for a little project I'm working on, and I'd forgotten how bad it was. I knew it was bad at the time. It's really absurd. And if you had to sum it up in two words, it would be online survey. It was just loads and loads of hastily cobbled together online surveys in which they show people the new plain packs and they show them the conventional packs and say, which one do you think is more attractive? which one do you think is more glamorous or sophisticated? And obviously people say, well, yeah, the normal ones are nicer than these ones, right? Mm. But there was never any reason to think this would translate into behavior. And it hasn't. And this RCT shows that. There's actually been a previous randomized control trial a few years ago showed exactly the same thing. None of this was picked up by the government. This government describes, like, this sounds like something to do.
I can remember debating this with some of the public health people at ASH. I said, but you're right, Chris, that the proof of it, or the assertion that this would work, I mean, to my mind, might well mean, and I hesitate to say this because perhaps it will become real, that if, supposing you made it obligatory for news agents and tobacconists to be extremely rude to people who buy a packet of cigarettes, right? So somebody goes, oh, like my packet of regular whatever it is, and the news agent is legally obliged to say, you are an idiot, and I hope you die, and you are a fool and a moron. And you then ask people, which is your preferred retail experience? Your regular shopkeeper saying, oh, it's lovely to see you again, Tom. Here's your carton of the usual, is it, sir? Or somebody who says, you idiot, you fool, you moron, what are you doing to yourself? You should be ashamed of yourself if you smoke cigarettes. And I mean, but I say, I hesitate to point that out because I wouldn't be surprised if that becomes the next public health policy, you know, a legal obligation on tobacconists to be rude to their customers. But as Chris says, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't appear to be impacting prevalence, right?
It hasn't at all. Yeah. I mean, we know that now. We've seen what happens in places where plain packaging comes in, and just nothing. Smokers, you know, they just get used to so much stuff that been getting in the air for so long. It's made literally no difference to cigarette consumption, to smoking rates, anything, anywhere in the world. And in fact, it's been interesting to see how few countries have actually followed our lead, as they say. There's about 8 or 9 countries, I think, around the world, but this is nearly 10 years after Australia brought it in. Usually these policies spread like wildfire because they're considered to be quite low cost and fairly popular. This one hasn't, and I'd like to think that's because somebody has been looking at the evidence, but probably not.
I mean, one thing that does seem to have had an impact on smoking rates is lockdown amongst young people, potentially.
Apparently.
I think it was Cancer Research UK's numbers. So among 18 to 34-year-olds, it's risen by about a quarter. So, Chris, any thoughts on this? Also, what does it mean for the banter hypothesis that smoking is the key prophylactic against COVID? Is this why it's come under control finally?
I would assume, these young people have been carefully following the science and reading the preprints and have seen that they're less likely to get
COVID if they smoke cigarettes.
I was waiting for the Snowden policy to be that the government intervention should be to dispatch a carton of B&H to every household once a week.
Free on the NHS.
Free on the NHS.
With your lateral flow.
Well, I know, Mark, I believe in science, and the science very clearly shows now. And you ask about the banter hypothesis. So this is the idea that smoking reduces your risk of getting infected with COVID-19. It seems to be entirely about infection. There's a bunch of people at UCL, I think, who've been doing a living meta-analysis. So they've been looking at all the studies that have been coming out about this specific question, of which have been loads. They're not getting covered in the media anymore, but there's been loads, and they're really quite consistent in what they're saying. And these guys, I mean, they're public health people, so I think they started looking at this question because they wanted to debunk it, basically, when it was in the news way back last spring. And they've done 6 or 7 updates of this, and they said with the last one, we're not going to do this anymore because it's just, there's no point. It's very clear that it reduces your risk. Average risk reduction is about 30%.
Is it? It's nicotine, presumably, that's doing that, well, not smoking per se. I mean,
No, because they've done 1 or 2 studies on vaping. It doesn't seem to have any effects. There is some study involving nicotine patches in France, and I'm not sure if they've come up with their final results, but I didn't get the impression it was going well. So more intriguingly,
That is bizarre then. I mean, yeah, I could understand that, yeah, what is it this does seem extraordinary. I mean, I just assumed it was nicotine, and, you know, so the smoking might still be bad for you, but maybe nicotine is a protector against COVID-19. Because I think I'm right, Chris, that nicotine is useful in quite a lot of medicines, wasn't it from the tobacco leaf they found some way to mitigate Ebola or something? I mean, there it does have some medicinal
You can
property.
Make vaccines from it, yeah, which is why BAT was making a vaccine, yeah. Still are, I think.
But it does seem to me very strange that it would be actually combustible smoke.
Yeah, but it does make it even funnier, doesn't it?
It certainly adds to the, it should be a capital B on the banter of the banter hypothesis, yeah.
Now, you've got a theory, haven't you, Mark, about why so many young people have supposedly been taken up smoking?
Well, a theory was put to me, which Chris poo-pooed, but I at least like the theory, was that lockdown has forced people to be honest about their smoking habit. So if you were, 21-year-old who lives with mum and dad, until the last 18 months, you were able to smoke without them noticing. But now you've been cooped up and locked in with them. Smokers are having to be more honest. So smokers are coming out rather than... so actually all it is that these youngsters are now have had to tell their parents because they can't just keep sneaking into the garage and having a cigarette without being noticed. So maybe lockdown has forced smokers or obliged smokers or encouraged smokers to admit that they're smokers, and maybe there hasn't been any change in consumption habits at all.
Out and proud. That's just the difference now. Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. We should talk a bit about Australia because it's getting a bit dark down there. So more than half of Australians are under lockdown at the moment, certainly in Sydney and Melbourne and Canberra, all the big cities. And it seems like all of the local authorities in these various different places are really going off the deep end with this in different ways. We've had helicopters chasing partying young people off of beaches in Sydney, protests in Melbourne where the rubber bullets came up. You probably don't mind that as much.
Chris is all in favour of that. Right, a bit of practice before dealing with XI.
XI was training, this is the real thing. But and they've also had this strange story, which it was a bit weird that it took this for it to hit home for a lot of people, but there was one town council called Coba, I think, which shot 15 impounded dogs because they were worried about people coming across town to come and collect them. Apparently, they haven't had any cases in that town for a month.
So it works. It works,
exactly. So let's put that to one side. But nevertheless, it's getting quite bad, isn't it? And obviously, the context for this is the fact that they've also, not only have they been pursuing this zero COVID policy or something approximating a zero COVID policy, there's some different state to state as well. But also, their vaccination program isn't really exactly going at all strengths. We're on about 32% double vaccinated at the moment. And you've got a public which is still probably as scared of COVID as we might have been circa early April 2020. Mark, what have you made of all of this?
It's extraordinary, really. But my guess would be, it's only a guess, I'm not certain of this, that the genie's out of the bottle now, that zero COVID can't work. And actually, Australia and New Zealand, of course, a similar story there, are now in for a very, very miserable year because this will spread and they will have to go through what we have gone through. You've either got to roll out the vax program fast and or, well, I suppose that's an element of getting to sort of herd immunity. But if the finger in the dike strategy doesn't work, and that's what they've been doing, putting the finger in the dike, at some point the dam bursts. But I was actually, earlier today, I had lunch with an Australian friend of mine. And he was like, there is actually a major problem now for the government. Having said that it's zero COVID, do you now actually, how do you communicate to the public? No, now we're actually taking the lid off, actually. I mean, loads of people are going to get it. I'm afraid a good number are going to get very ill. Some will even die. Bad luck. The main aim is to make sure that the hospitals aren't overwhelmed. It's very difficult to segue to that, you know, somewhat more liberal policy from the zero. But if zero doesn't work, and it looks like it isn't going to work, then the whole thing falls like a deck of cards pretty fast, right?
So seemingly it's just that even the toughest Australian-style lockdown can't contain the Delta variant, presumably.
That seems to be the lesson. And also in New Zealand too. I mean, they've certainly suppressed the numbers. I mean, if they didn't have a lockdown, it'd be going through the roof. They're still at relatively low numbers in New South Wales and Victoria. But, yeah, it's... that's the only tool in the box and it's not working. So it seems to me that they're stuck in lockdown because I don't think they can just say, well, we're sorry, we're going to let it rip with so few people being vaccinated. If you look at somewhere like Florida, where they've got way more people being vaccinated, it's still a nightmare situation they're facing over there. I'm not sure you when you say that the public are as scared of it as ever, I'm not sure that's true. It seems to me that all the protests and just the fact that it's spreading suggests that people probably aren't that scared of it and that people are still mixing in a clandestine fashion. But yeah, if Delta is too strong for even pretty tough lockdowns, I just don't see where they've got to go.
Why is the vaccination rollout been so pathetic? I mean,
because they were being complacent. Partly they were complacent because they thought there was zero COVID. They had all the time in the world. And partly because they scared everybody off taking the AstraZeneca one, when there were reports of blood clots, including like the government. The government was complicit in scaring people about the AstraZeneca vaccine. And as I understand it, the AstraZeneca vaccine is the only one they can actually manufacture in Australia. And they didn't put enough orders in, and nor did right. New Zealand. But every country balls this up in their own way.
Is the way to segue out of this for them to now put their foot to the floor on vaccinating?
Yeah, but it'll take a while. I mean, it'll take months.
And there is still that question, as you were talking about, Mark, of because obviously there are people who are breaking lockdown now, and you're seeing, therefore, the state premiers in particular getting more and more authoritarian, but also more and more testing. I mean, that moment from, what, a week ago, we had Dan Andrews, the premier in Victoria, making this announcement that it was now illegal, or at least certainly not advised, to pull your mask down to drink alcohol outside. Yes. So it seems like this was a scandal because there are various places which had set up kind of beer gardens where people could go and have a drink and people were kind of congregating around them. Just this ridiculous puritanical display. I think you said it's called takeaway. Take away, not hang around. Like, it's just this really ridiculous. That's the sort of extent that they're going to.
Well, they're desperate, aren't they?
They are desperate. But at the same time, it does seem like, aside from there's natural fatigue with the restrictions as well, like you talk to people in Australia, a lot of them just genuinely don't know anyone who's had COVID.
Exactly.
If you say you've had it, they talk to you as if you'd survived a scrape of Ebola or something. They're absolutely fascinated. So there is that question, surely, that even once you get the vaccination up to a certain point, there is going to be that level of kind of nervousness with it being an endemic virus, surely.
Well, they're going to accept that lots of people are going to die in the same way we're accepting quite a few people are dying even now with a very largely vaccinated population. And I don't think Jacinda in particular is ready to grasp that nettle. You know, even if they get up to 60, 70% vaccinated adults, I'm not sure that she's got the bottle to say, look, we think we did a pretty good job. We did keep a zero COVID more or less for a long time, but now we're going to have to open up. And unfortunately, the vaccines don't work 100% and people are going to die. I don't know if the Kiwis are ready for that.
Mm. Are the economic consequences there disastrous? I genuinely ask that. I haven't looked at the figures, but I mean, lockdowns of this type are associated with, you know, colossal business failures, unemployment, massive falls in GDP.
Yeah, it's a bad situation. And they're looking at a very long lockdown, I think, now in both those countries, just to suppress the cases. I don't think, I could be wrong, I hope I am wrong, but I don't think they're going to get it back to zero. So,
well, it's almost impossible now, isn't it, to get it back to zero?
I think so, yeah.
Unless they've become even more of a hermit kingdom. I guess I don't know how they could possibly do that. But Mark, just finally, you know, libertarians in particular was a bit of a soft spot for Australia because it's kind of gung-ho liberal place. But nevertheless, has in the same way that people feel that they've been surprised how quickly various different Western countries have gone down a very authoritarian route. Is Australian society just, again, kind of as unrecognisable in that sense? Has it changed quite significantly?
Yeah, I mean, I've only visited Australia once, but I keep a beady eye on it. And I always try and press Chris on this point. Oddly, the sort of Anglosphere is unbelievably Puritan. They basically killed the nighttime industries business in most of Australia, haven't they? I mean, absolutely unbelievable. There's no, nightlife has been basically regulated out of existence. So I do see Australia as a particularly gung-ho place. I probably do economically, right, from an IA perspective. Taxes are rather lower than they tend to be in most other developed countries, right? You know, employment regulation and red tape in many areas isn't too strong. But on lifestyle, you know, Australia, Ireland, the UK, you say we're the worst of the bunch.
Oh, he's been talking about plain packaging. They were the ones who
I keep trying to press Chris on this one. I know the nanny state index compares EU countries, the European countries, but I'm trying to work out what's underlying this. It seems actually Catholic countries are less Puritan than Protestant countries. I mean, okay, that's a massive, I'm not really sure I count it as a Protestant country, but Catholic countries seem to be much more relaxed about lifestyle sins than Protestant countries. Does seem to be a feature, is that right?
You are spot on. This is what the academic research that's looked at this thing reckons this happens. It all comes back to the prohibition movement, the temperance movement, and the two things that kind of predict whether you're going to have a big temperance lobby, which then mutates into an anti-smoking lobby, anti-sugar lobby, all the rest of it, is Protestant versus Catholic and spirits or beer drinking versus wine drinking. And if you're a wine drinking Catholic country, you're going to be probably pretty chill in general.
Yeah.
That's nearly always the case. If you are Protestant and you go a lot of spirits drinking in particular, you're going to be pretty uptight about it. Ireland is a weird one because, of course, it's Catholic but very puritanical. But it's kind of the exception that proves the rule.
So pray for Australia in more ways than one.
Yeah, yeah. I've never seen it as a libertarian country at all. I don't know where you get that from. I mean, quite like the opposite. It's horrendously woke and puritanical. Clive James said that the problem with Australia wasn't that it was populated with prisoners, but it was populated with prison wardens. I think that's absolutely true.
I think that's a perfect place to end it. Chris, Mark, thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.